Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Underrated Movie Podcast, a podcast where we take a look at underrated and underappreciated films. I am your host, Derek McDuff, and today we're going to be talking about a film that I've had on the docket for a while, and that would be Sam Raimi's Spider-Man 3. And joining me today, my esteemed guest from the Midnight Film Society, the other podcast that I do, is Damian P. Sherman. How's it going? How's it going, Damian?
Pretty good, man. How are you?
Good, good. For anyone out there who's not aware, by the way, Happy New Year to everybody.
Yes.
For anybody who is not aware, this is the first day of the podcast getting a kind of a rebrand, keeping the same name and everything, but some new artwork, all that good stuff. And yeah, we'll be releasing still every other Wednesday, or sorry, every other Monday. But, you know, now it's going to be on a different Monday, so that's why we got two episodes in a row, which also means that now me and Damian's shows, which used to be on the same day, will get released on opposite weeks. So if you won't have to hear me twice on the same day if you are listening to both of those shows. You can space out your Derek listening, which, yeah. We recently had a rebrand over there on Midnight Film Society as well. I don't know if you wanted to mention that to the people.
Yeah, new rebrand, new artwork. I commissioned a podcast artwork from the same person that does. If anybody's familiar with Criminal, their podcast, every episode has a new and unique piece of artwork. Fortunately, don't have her name offhand, but go to criminal.com and check out the artwork there. I got the same person to do my artwork, and it's one of the best. I told her this. It's one of the best commissioned pieces of art I've done for any sort of podcasting thing I've done so far. So definitely check that stuff out. Definitely did a big rebrand because, you know, for a while we've been doing pretty much straight film reviews for the last couple of years. So I thought it was high time to finally put a new coat of paint on the old podcast wagon over there. So, yep, it's under the same feed as Can I Say Something. So if you're subscribed to that podcast, don't have to do anything. It's on the same bat channel, same bat time, every other Monday. You can get that anywhere you get podcasts.
Right, right. Very nice. And then that reminds me, I should shout out my friend Connor, who I commissioned to do the new podcast artwork for Underrated, which I am very happy with. Check out his stuff, Little Guy Designs. He's also got some t-shirts and stuff I've bought a couple of as well. He's a great artist and, you know, did some great work for me. So I was very happy with that. Also, the Midnight Film Society artwork looks awesome as well. So check both of that stuff out. And then I also did new artwork, new branding for the Patreon. It's called Underrated Disc 2 now. Still on the same Underrated Movie Podcast on Patreon, but now it's got a whole new look and everything. But, you know, now all the housekeeping at the top is out of the way.
Yes.
Let's dive into this one, this 2007, or Swing Into It, rather, you should say.
Swing Into It, yes.
So, yeah, this is
the... What's the sound?
Yeah, thank you. But,
What's the sound he makes when they... What's
the wick? It's Thwick.
Thank you.
Thwick. Yeah, yes. Thwick. Yes.
Sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah, but yeah, as we all know, this is directed by Sam Raimi, who directed all three films in the original Spider-Man trilogy. Of course, starring Tobey Maguire, Kristen Dunst, and James Franco. Along with this time, they are joined by the likes of Thomas Hayden Church, Topher Grace, and Bryce Dallas Howard, of course, with, you know, actors like J.K. Simmons in his iconic role as J. Jonah Jameson.
Yes.
Screenplay by Raimi and his brother Ivan, as well as Alvin Sargent, Oscar-winning screenwriter. And this will become important later, edited by Bob Murawski, who is also won an Academy Award. But Damian, when this one dropped in 2007, what did you think of it, and what have you thought of it over the years? I know this one has quite the reputation online, to say the least.
Massive reputation. It doesn't need to be said. Just one more note of the sort of below the line credits there. Christopher Young does the music, stepping in for the famously Danny Elfman did the scores for the first two films. So I did I don't know if I noticed. I don't know if somebody asked me, was that the same guy? I probably wouldn't have known. You know, I don't know if you noticed any sort of difference between this one and the first two in that respect.
Yeah, it's something that I think at the time, I feel like subconsciously I was like, is this a little bit different? Then I saw it wasn't Elfman. I was like, oh, that makes sense. It wasn't a thing where like I would have like, this is definitely not him. But when somebody told me, I was like, okay, I get that.
Yeah.
But yeah, I have some stuff to say about his score. Not a ton, but a little bit. I've got a couple notes on his score as well.
Yes.
But yeah, he stepped in because Danny Elfman is a big old creep. I don't know if people know this, but yeah, he's kind of got a reputation.
Yes, he does. So yeah, overall, what I thought of this, when I have succinct memories of seeing this the day it came out. The theater was packed. This was before they had reservation seating, so I believe we probably got a seat somewhere up front. We got there pretty late. Big anticipation there. This is 07. So this is a year before Iron Man. That was probably in the works, but I didn't really have any idea that it was being in the works. So I wasn't really as into filmmaking and keeping up on I didn't have my finger on the pulse, as I would say, on media as much as I do now. So went into this as a spry 22-year-old, loving the first movie, loving the second movie. Obviously, the second is held up as one of the best movies, superheroes movies of all time. So this is a few years after that. Had no idea about, you know, any behind the scenes of like, oh, so they have a new villain. That's going to be too much. I had no idea about the behind the scenes of people like Avi Arad, which alongside Isaac Perlmutter got the rights to the movie adaptation. So he had a lot to do with, we'll get into it later, but he had a lot to do with the villains that were in this. Again, no idea back then. So to answer your question, back then, highly anticipated it. And when I saw it and I liked it and walked out, I was like, yeah, that was weird. I think weird and off kilter. And I was like, okay. You know, in the halcyonic days of being a young person and being somebody that didn't think about media critically as I do now, I probably came out of this as like, I don't know. Something was weird about that, but I don't know how I feel about it. You know, it's one of those like, if your sexual awakening, you have like those weird feelings of like, what is this? What is this feeling I'm feeling of like, you know, and walking out of this, I had feelings of like, something's not right. I don't know what's going on. I can't put my finger on it. I can't articulate my feelings very well about this, but that didn't feel right. And so jump to now seeing it for the first time. This is probably my first time seeing it since then in full. Still didn't like it. I don't think it's a great movie. I don't think it's a good movie. I think some of the digital effects hold up fairly well. I think James Franco, in the light of being a creep, the things he does in this movie do hit very, very differently than they did back then. So overall, didn't like it then. Still don't like it now, basically. That's my overall thoughts on Spider-Man 3.
Right, right. And, you know, we had talked about beforehand, I asked you to watch the editor's cut, which I got a chance to check out. Did you get, and you said you did not get a chance to do that. Is that correct?
Right. So the thing was like, I didn't watch it. So I watched the regular version where you can sort of compare notes there.
Mm-hmm.
And so the editor's version I read was, you know, they had a few minutes added here, some taken off there. So in terms of like, was it, it's not a 3-hour cut or it's not the Snyder cut. It's not, not a lot of like major plot beats or plot points were changed. So overall, tell me what. So I saw the same version I saw back in 2007. You saw a different version. Can you tell us what was different and how it affected your enjoyment of watching it?
Yeah, let me back up a little bit because, I do want to talk about, you know, this is not a thing that is widely known that there is this editor's cut that came out a couple of years ago by Murawski, the original editor, who, you know, I have a lot of respect for. He edited all these movies, edits most of Raimi's movies. He won that Oscar for The Hurt Locker and saw this as something he wanted to go back to. And, you know, I had a very similar experience to you when I originally saw this, where I watched it and I was like, I liked that, but there was something kind of off about it. There was something kind of weird about it. And I had, though, a lot of knowledge going into it, like who the villains were going to be and stuff like that. Like I was a really big Spider-Man. Spider-Man was my favorite superhero at the time, and he might still be. So I was very big into the first movies. I watched the shows in the 90s. I had seen Thomas Hayden Church on like Conan or something, and he had this whole thing where he's like, I'm not allowed to say what the name of the villain is, but I can say the name of like the person. And he was like, I'm Flint Marco. And then the crowd was like, Sandman. And he was like, I can't confirm or deny. Like, it was one of those things. But so I kind of knew going in what it was going to be, and knowing I loved Venom from the old TV show. So I was like hyped on that. And I think that Avi Arad and, you know, some other studio people were like, we've got to put Venom in this movie. And I think that had a lot of, that was not the story that Raimi wanted to tell. Raimi was much more interested in this Sandman story and that whole arc, which I think is the much stronger thing. And I think that it does get a little crowded, a little bit convoluted with all the Venom stuff. But I think that a positive thing that came from the Venom stuff is the black suit Spider-Man. And, you know, Toby's whole thing, or Spider-Man / Peter Parker's whole thing about anger and vengeance and not letting, being able to let go of the past and this cycle of revenge, and how, you know, and I had mixed feelings about the retcon of Uncle Ben's death, but I think and, you know, it kind of makes little things a little bit messy in the first two, but it makes sense in this movie because it's like, oh, he created me, and then Peter kind of creates him. Like, you know, the Sandman is such a, like these Spider-Man movies, unlike a lot of superhero movies today, which are like, oh, well, the villain's sympathetic.
Yeah.
But they're doing an evil thing for a good reason. This one is just like, yeah, these are guys who, you know, just kind of end up being like mad scientists who destroy themselves. Or in this one, it's just a guy who, as he puts it, you know, he's not a bad person. He's just had bad luck. And he's like robbing banks, but he's not like an egomaniacal person who's like trying to take, he's like robbing banks because he has a sick daughter, you know, like it's like, and he has a daughter who has cancer or some unspecified disease, and Spider-Man's out there trying to stop him. And he's like, yeah, I want to, you know, stop Spider-Man because he keeps stopping me. I'm trying to provide for my daughter. And those thematic elements all work very well in tandem. I think that it just got cluttered with other things. And I think that, and because I've seen this movie multiple times over the years, and I even wrote a piece way, way back in the day for like a personal blog, for this blog that I used to do, about when the Amazing Spider-Man movies came out, about how it was, 3 was a much better film than those. And it kind of has this reputation on the internet where it's like, yeah, people who, like, you know, you hadn't seen the movie in years, but everyone like is like, oh, well, yeah, that's a bad movie. Yeah. And I think that that reputation is kind of undeserved. It's not a perfect movie. There's definitely issues with it, but people tend to think of it as like, oh, this movie's so bad, it killed the franchise, and like critics hate it. And it's like, no, it had a fresh score on Rotten Tomatoes, and it made a lot of money. It was like the highest grossing superhero movie at the time until the MCU came out. It was the highest grossing Spider-Man movie until Far From Home came out. It's just that Spider-Man 4, they were starting production of Spider-Man 4, and the studio once again is like, cool, we want this stuff all like by this day. And Raimi was like, I just dealt with all this other studio interference, I'm leaving. Raimi leaves, so Toby leaves, so they just rebooted instead. Which, you know, we all saw how that went.
Yeah.
But to answer your original question, I was very curious, because this was a movie that always felt like, this is a good movie. It's just, there's just some things that are just kind of off about it. Mm-hmm. And as you mentioned, it's not a majorly different movie. It's not like the Zack Snyder Justice League. It's not Ridley Scott's director's cut of Kingdom Heaven. So the point where when I rent it, because it came out originally as like a bonus feature for like a Blu-ray or something, this editor's cut, or it's also been called Spider-Man 3.1. And when I went in, I was like, did I get the wrong thing? Did I just rent the regular version? Because it's pretty close. But a lot of the tweaks that are pretty minor make a lot of difference, and I think speak to the power of just editing and flow. And a lot of times when you see these cuts, you know, these alternate visions, because directors get seen incorrectly, in my opinion, as these ultimate auteurs of the movie, they're the ones who have the power. But I love that it was an editor this time who was like, no, let me go in and tweak some things. And he uses some alternate cuts. There's a lot more stuff about the suit kind of corrupting Spider-Man and the negative pull it has. There's an alternate scene with the Ditkoviches where he apologizes to Ursula instead of the dad, which I think is a much better character thing. There's a lot of little moments like that. There's like a couple like little, there's some alternate takes. There's the one, the fight that they have at the end starts a little differently. I was worried they were going to take out the dance sequence, which I'm sure we'll get, or the, you know, the kind of like Spider-Man James Brown strut, which I know people on the internet don't like it, but I think it's so Sam Raimi and so perfect. But they keep that in. But there's a lot less Venom stuff. Topher Grace is reduced, I think, drastically and appropriately to where he is just kind of there to be this clone figure, to take a John Truby term. He's kind of the dark version of Spider-Man. He's created by his hate. You know, I love that he says, get religion. And then so he goes to a church and prays for him to die. And then that's where he gets the Venom symbiote. And so, gotcha, you know, gotcha. He's there as the shadow to Spider-Man. And he serves the plot more appropriately, I feel like, in the editor's cut. But I think the thing that the editor's cut does the best and made me so happy when I saw it is there's a moment towards the end of Spider-Man 3 that I despise, that I think most people despise, that I think actively kind of ruins the movie and almost tips it over into it being a bad movie for me. It's when, and this is something that's been parodied to death on the internet, when, you know, he's like, come help me out. Help me find the Sandman. You know, Spider-Man shows up at Goblin's house and he's like, help me find the Sandman. And he's like, no, fuck off. Yeah. And then the butler comes out of nowhere and is like, your father got killed by his own thing. And you're like, it's so bad. It's so fucking dumb. That is replaced by, instead, he looks at a picture that is broken of the three of them from better times. And I think what that does that is so important is it takes out that contrivance, first of all, which is a bad, dumb contrivance. Yeah. And instead of it just being like, he makes the Goblin gets this redemption, he makes this decision because of some outside force that completely takes away his agency and his ability to see his father as he truly is and to see his friends as they truly are, it puts it back on him. It puts it all in his own headspace and makes that decision once again his own decision. And it makes that arc that these characters have had over the three films hit so much, you know, they're friends in the first one. It ends with that, you know, I want Spider-Man dead in the first one. And then when the second one, that was one of my favorite cliffhangers ever, is like pulls off the mask. Oh my God, it's my best friend, Peter. He's betrayed me. And for him to kind of fully realize like, no, he never really betrayed me. Yeah. It's I have been in the wrong. And for him to actively make that decision really strengthens the end of this movie for me. So yeah, those, to answer your question, long story short, those are the differences.
Gotcha. The guy that told him about that, his butler, was John Paxton. It was Bill Paxton's father, actually.
Oh, wow. Bernard. Yeah. No, he has one of the great lines in the movie when he's just like, Bernard, do I have any girlfriends? Not that I know of, sir.
That's awesome. Yeah, really well said. I do just want to point to one thing that I saw in this movie that really bugged me, which I understand, like, superhero movies are generally held to a different standard, right? We can't just, you can say that it has to make sense. It has to have a good storyline. It has to have these sympathetic parts. A superhero movie still has to adhere to storytelling parameters of, did you make me feel something for the character? Did you provide a good motivation? Those type of things, right? But there are those, you know, superhero movies probably never win an Oscar for Best Picture. I understand that, right? It's not Citizen Kane that everyone says. But there was a speech or some kind of lesson or some kind of presentation that Trey Parker and Matt Stone were giving. I don't know if you heard about this, where they talk about the and then speech of like...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so I have it pulled up here. They said, quote, "We found out this really simple rule that maybe you guys have already heard before, but we took a long time to learn it. We can take these beats, which are basically the beats of your outline, the words, and if the words and then belong in between those beats, you're fucked. Basically, you've got something pretty boring. What should happen between every beat is you've written down, it's either the word therefore or but. What I'm saying is, if you come up with an idea and it's like, so this happens, right? But then that happens. No. It should be this happens and therefore this happens. But this happens, therefore this happens. Literally, we'll write down something to make sure we're doing it. We have our beats. We'll say, okay, this happens and this happens. And that affects this and does that. That's why you get a show that feels like this to that, this to that. Here's complication to that. Matt Stone said, fuck, I see these movies. You see these movies where you're just watching and this happens and then this happens and this happens. And then you're like in a movie and you're like, what am I watching this for? So in this movie, I'm not sure if it was in a lot of the other Spider-Man movies. I haven't rewatched them before, but I'm just going to quickly go through some of the major beats of this movie. It's a movie that I think doesn't stand on its own very well because, you know, at the beginning they do this quick rush through of like in the opening credits, they show the first one, they show the second one. So if you haven't seen those two, you're kind of quickly caught up, right? Mm-hmm. But James Franco's character, you know, the what's his name?
Harry Osborn.
Harry Osborn. Yeah, he's just like, I hate Spider-Man. I know I hate Peter Parker. I hate both of them. Very quickly just goes through and gets the powers and then starts fighting him and then gets hit in the head and it doesn't remember things. His arc in this movie, like you said, probably ends very, very well, like you said, because of the editing, because of the new scene put in there, the way they flesh his character out at the end. In your version, it does sound very good. But the things he does in this movie, like he said, are then he does this, and then he gets the powers, and then he attacks Peter Parker, and then he gets his memory lost. There's no, this thing happened because of that thing, therefore this happened. There was no but. There was no, like you said, agency. There was very little agency in Harry Osborn's character. And if you look at the reason that Peter Parker does the things he does, why does he do them? Because he got stuck with, and then the asteroid lands on Earth, and then it sticks to Peter Parker, and then he gets really angry and really emo. See what I'm saying? Like all that, a lot of the reasons for the plot points in this movie are that something else is shoving them towards it. Like again, the Venom is a very good example of, you know, it attaches itself to Topher Grace, attaches itself to Eddie Brock. And so, therefore, he attacks Peter Parker. There's so many moments in this movie that I'm just like, so the motivation behind what they're doing isn't because of the thing we saw in this movie or a thing that they are, like you said, very well. At the end, like you said, in the original version, the butler says to him, this thing happened, right? So the butler is, like you said, in the original version, the butler says to him, your father didn't get killed by Peter Parker. He did himself, right? So like you said, takes away his energy, that takes away his motivation to then make up with Peter Parker and help him fight the Venom and the Sandman, right? So
yeah, okay,
right? Am I getting?
I mean, I kind of disagree with you, to be honest. I think that there is a pretty clear, like you say, okay, so yeah, he, you know, there is and thens from before the movie, like, I mean, but it's the end of a trilogy, so that makes sense. So in the last movie, he saw that he was Spider-Man, so therefore he goes to fight him, and he hits his head, and therefore he has no memory. So therefore, Peter Parker is thinking that his life is happy, everything's going well, and he starts to take his relationship for granted, and kind of backtalks to Mary Jane. Then that causes, or therefore... That causes Mary Jane.
Is it therefore, or is it that and then?
Yes, therefore he's taking his relationship for granted. So she goes to Harry because she doesn't trust Peter because she can't talk to him. She's tried multiple times.
That was a forced relationship. That was a massively forced relationship there, I thought. In the previous movies, again, I haven't seen the previous movies in a long time.
Let me continue. Therefore she goes to him. Therefore they start to have a connection because she feels more of a connection because she's getting drawn away from Peter and kisses him. And therefore his memories come back. And therefore he goes to Peter and tries to attack him once again. And therefore gets his ass kicked. And therefore, when Peter comes back to him again, they start to reconcile a little bit. So I kind of disagree with your analysis there, to be honest.
I think you could make the case as both. I think it could be seen as both. Like I said, I just read the book Normal People, a very good book. I recommend it. A lot of the conflict in that book, and this is a conflict, what would you call it? A conflict mechanism or conflict generating a theme, which is either miscommunication or no communication, or somebody just it's a very big trope in sitcoms where somebody will not communicate what they're feeling or thinking or doing or the motivation behind what they're doing, and therefore is the conflict. And I think it's a very artificial, it's a very weak sort of storytelling tool, is to have two people in a situation where it could have been solved. And again, I understand that's a well-worn trope, and it's a trope that's in a lot of movies, not just superhero movies. I get that, but it's a trope that I really can't stand. And it's in this movie where you have him getting the Venom on him, right? And okay, so his psyche is affected by the Venom, and therefore he can't speak the way he wants to. He can't communicate that I just had this weird Venom thing attack me. And did he get the Venom before or after he kissed Gwen Stacy on that presentation or whatever.
It was after, and the Venom is kind of attracted to him because of him being angry. Reflected. Like it gets more attracted to him when he finds out about the Sandman being his father's real murderer and the rage that starts to build. And I think it makes sense in this almost like Norse Viking cycle of vengeance that just kind of builds and builds, and how this, the black goo, the Venom suit, becomes this literal personification of just anger and vengeance that passes from one person to the next. And then Topher Grace, because he is angry at Peter Parker and Spider-Man, gets infected by the rage, the anger that was infecting Peter Parker, and that cycle just keeps going and going until the end. The cycle is finally ultimately broken because Peter forgives the Sandman in the end, which is a really powerful moment for me. And I get what you're saying, because, you know, this is an overstuffed movie. This is a movie that admittedly is overstuffed with too many villains, a lot of plot lines, and they do jump back and forth between them. So the through lines are maybe a little bit muddied. I think that is a problem that is a little bit mitigated in, once again, the editor's cut, which I know most people haven't seen, but I still want to talk about it because I think it does solve these problems, because a lot of the scenes are presented in a different order. There's one scene that I didn't mention before that I think is a really powerful scene, where you see the Sandman in, he just becomes a sandcastle and his daughter sees it. There's this really tender, sweet moment. So yeah, and I think that really does speak to the power of editing and how something in one cut can feel like, oh, this just happened because it needed to happen at this point in the film. Whereas this new cut flows a lot better. It's a lot more interesting. And, you know, they did have 10 years of hindsight in internet reactions, but it doesn't seem reactionary, because there's some things in that editor's cut that stayed in that were big butts of jokes of the internet for a long time, and they stayed in the movie.
Just speaking to like the overall tone of it, you mentioned the editing, the editor's cut does, like you said, mitigate some of the weird tonal shifts in the original cut. I do, again, trying to defend the movie a little bit, or defend the genre a little bit, and sort of, or defending the movie because it isn't any genre that is known for being goofy and cheesy and saccharine and all of that stuff. So just to speak to like specifically the him going emo and those dance movements, and I cringe watching this right just now while watching it. And maybe that's the point. Again, I assume your response would be, you know, that's the point. You're supposed to cringe at it. You're supposed to think that his behavior is childish and selfish and machoistic and all of these things that you would look at and just go, oh God, Jesus, why would you whisper in that woman's ear so sensually, hey babe, hey toots, get us a good seat. Oh God,
dude. Find us some shade.
Find us some shade.
Now dig on this. Meme culture has reclaimed this movie. TikTok loves this movie.
Fuck. That's fine. They can. TikTok enjoys a lot of things that I don't. But yeah, just that all of that was so like, you know, and I guess the whole point of it was for him to insult Mary Jane again because he saw her there and he's just like rubbing it in her face. What'd you think of, you know, an early Bryce Dallas Howard? She was in a couple of Shyamalan movies, I think, before this, but there's one of her big breakout roles. What did you think of her in this?
I think she was good. I definitely think she was interesting. She was a really good foil. I think that, you know, a lot of people pointed out that, you know, her character and Mary Jane's characters would have been switched from what they were more traditionally like in the comics, which I think is interesting. And interestingly enough, in real life, she's a redhead, and Kirsten Dunst is a blonde, so they had even a hairstyle switch. But yeah, I thought she was really good. I think that all the casts that come into this are good. But I also wanted, you talked about a lot about the cringy stuff, you know, and that being like a thing of the genre and the cheesiness. And I think that's less of a genre convention and more of like a Sam Raimi kind of thing, because all of his movies have that kind of quality where it's like almost kind of cringe, but it's just like really over the top and goofy and ridiculous. Like all of his movies are like watch Drag Me to Hell. That's just like over the top. And that's how all of these movies are, you know, that's how it's been since Evil Dead. And I kind of like watch it in, you know, that same with that Sam Raimi appreciation and, you know, watching being like, yeah, what would a dork think is cool? Like Spider-Man is a dork and he's not instantly because he gets Venom and's trying to be cool, going to actually be cool. This is what a not cool person's idea of a cool person is. So I thought that really, you know, one thing that Murrowski compared it to was he's like, you know, he would have this montage of him walking around and stuff like that, just like there was in Spider-Man 2, where they had the raindrops keep falling on my head one. And this one, he's like, I used James Brown in the same way that I used Burt Bacharach in the last one. So that all really worked for me in the level of the Raimi campiness. Frame is present in the other ones. And I think that this movie balances those tones a lot better. All three of these movies, the Spider-Man films, balance those tones a lot better than a lot of modern day superhero movies where, you know, some will just say a joke. And whereas here, it's just like, you know, something funny will happen and something tragic will happen. You're like, oh, wow, like that kind of. You hit me all at once. It's not just like, we need someone to say a joke now because it's been 5 minutes. It feels like very true to the style of filmmaking. We haven't even mentioned the man himself who cameos in all of Sam Raimi's movies. And of course here playing this snooty French maitre d'. Yeah. So, oh my gosh, I'm like spacing on everybody's names today.
Yes, Bruce Campbell.
Bruce Campbell, thank you. Bruce Campbell, how could I forget? He's so iconic. So, yeah. I don't know, how do you feel about like the whole kind of Raimi style, the Raimi vibes of this movie?
Yeah, that's again, one of my big problems with the movie is that there's very long, drawn out scenes of character building and interpersonal relationship building, especially with, you know, Rosemary Harris's May Parker. I think that scene worked very well. I think she's one of the best May Parkers. I think it's they're going in the direction of Aunt May going to be hot. Aunt May has gotten hotter progressively over these movies.
So you're saying Aunt May is not hot enough for you in this movie?
In this movie, I'm sorry, I'm not a gilf. That is not one of my predilections. No,
I mean, I don't know that that's what I'm going for when I watch an Aunt May role, but sure.
Yeah, I don't know, man. I think that it's. It's a good, like I was going to say, it's a good scene isolated by itself. And the scene with him dancing is funny and goofy in and of itself, right? And the family stuff with Sandman, good in and of itself. I like that scene isolated, compartmentalized by itself. All those things work together very well by themselves. Then you mix it into one movie, it doesn't work for me. I'm sorry. And also the fact that each of those scenes I just mentioned go on for a very long time. I think if you just trim some of that down, it would have been a lot more digestible to have not as much of any of those things. And I do want to just speak to one thing where I saw a rumor that they were thinking about splitting this movie into two because of how much story and characters are introduced into this movie. I saw that and they said that one of the reasons they didn't do that was because they couldn't find a good place to leave off the first half of the movie. And one thing I did write down, I just wanted to speak to you about the overstuffedness of it. Because when we talk about this movie, we say, well, they introduced Brock, they introduced Gwen Stacy, and they introduced Sandman. So those are, you know, three characters. Actually, it's six. If you think about the fact, well, not Bryce Dallas Howard, not Gwen Stacy, but the other two are villains. They're people, but then they have a separate, you know, villain character. So when you're introducing two characters that are villains, you're introducing the person with the backstory, with the family and all of that, right? But then you also have to introduce the villain. What's the villain? What are their power sets? What's the accident? What are they? And then you have to establish them as dangerous, as scary, because it's very hard to do in the third movie because you already established your hero as somebody who can take on very strong and very scary and very powerful villains. So I think all of that combined of like having all of that to introduce and to make sure the audience is aware of the fact that they are scary and powerful. And there is a chance, a small chance, obviously, but a chance that our hero can lose to these people, even though we've seen them overcome very powerful villains in the past. So I thought that was just something worth mentioning there.
Yeah, I mean, and you touched on a few things. You mentioned that, because that is true, they did talk about potentially splitting this one into two movies, which at the time I was like, maybe they should have done that. But the more I think about that over the years, the more I'm glad they didn't, because I have really come to loathe those two film split movies. We've got like three of them this year where we just got part ones of movies, and all of them, well, I guess two this year and one last year. Well, no, there's three this year and then a couple last year too. And all of them have felt unfinished. Even the Spider-Man movie that came out this year, which was very good, I left the theater being like, well, that was not a whole movie. That was half of a movie. And I really want to watch a full movie. Even The Lord of the Rings, which, by the way, Lord of the Rings Two Towers introduces a shit ton of characters. And so it shows you can do it. Like, there's nothing that says you can't just introduce six new characters and it's going to necessarily automatically be a bad thing. There's definitely ways to do that. But, you know, if you can build a way to have a finale that feels like an actual end of a movie, like Helm's Deep at the end of Two Towers, like the Breaking the Fellowship at the end of the first one, and it doesn't feel cheapened, then sure, go for it. But if it's just something like, well, we're on this train chase and now the guy's over there, or Dominic Toretto just stopped in the middle of the movie, like, those things really bug me. I've never liked that. That became a trend that I just really disliked, and I would much rather see them, if they said, yeah, we didn't have a way to end Spider-Man 3 without, you know, with Avin inclusion, I'm glad they didn't do that.
Yeah.
It's another thing where, you know, once I sound like a broken record, but the editor, you know, this movie is a little overstuffed. The editor's cut is actually shorter. Despite adding a scene, adding some other like stuff, they take away a lot more than they add, which is one of the few times I can think of when the cut that gets released, the editor's / director's cut, whatever it is shorter. The only other one I can think of is Alien, where they cut like the long ship sequence at the beginning. So I do appreciate that as well. And you know, this isn't like a perfect movie or anything, but I think that what I really love about it is just the themes of vengeance. And it's very Shakespearean. You have these characters who see themselves essentially as brothers, Peter and Harry, and they're kind of now set to be mortal enemies. They're sort of in love with the same woman, and you know, they have this titanic clash, this superpowered clash. And while Peter is also dealing with these feelings of vengeance and stuff that he gets, and on a level, maybe that is too much from one movie. Maybe you should have just done Venom or Spider-Man or Sandman or Goblin, or maybe even just two of them. But I think that it's still ultimately, there's a lot more, even in the theatrical cut, that I like than I dislike.
Yeah. You know, they had George Stacy, just looking up the Wikipedia, they had George Stacy. So my thing about them introducing three characters was actually six characters. You know, you have James Cromwell playing the father in there, which was very interesting. I just think overall, you know, you can look at a relationship and be like, well, why did that relationship got together very quickly and that or fell apart very quickly. You have, I just think that too, of their Peter and Mary Jane's relationship falls apart very quickly. She gets together with Harry Osborn.
Do you think it falls? Because I feel like there's a lot of stuff where he's just kind of like, I'm just like, dude, you suck. Like, just like every time, because I know people like that where you'll tell them like your problem and they're like, well, when this happened to me, and I'm just like, stop talking. And then the ultimate betrayal when he just kind of quick kisses Gwen upside down, and I'm just like the kid in the crowd, just like, no, Spidey, no.
Yeah. I guess my problem with it is that they got together at the end of the second one, right? It was like a will they, won't they until the end of the second one, correct?
Yeah, get together at the end. Yeah. But I mean, that's after two movies of build-up, I will say.
But my point is that they got together at the end of the first one. They break up at the beginning of the first one. It seems very hurried. But my other point was just the melding and breaking of relationships happens very quickly. Their relationship ends very quickly. You have her getting together with Harry fairly quickly. And then also you have,
getting together. They just have a kiss and she's like, shit, I shouldn't have done that.
True. Venom and Venom encounters Sandman. It was like, hey, I hate Peter Parker too. Let's work together. And Sandman's like, okay. Just like, what are you? Are you going to hurt me? What do you want? Are we going to be together after this? Like, just a quick little back and forth of like, what the fuck are you? Okay. He just says, okay. It just seemed very quickly for quick for me. Just to speak to how quick the relationships are mended and broken in this movie. Just seems very abrupt to me. That's all I'm trying to say.
I guess that's a fair point. Like I said, this is, especially the theatrical cut, a pretty overstuffed movie.
Yeah.
But those are all fair points. Did the themes affect you at all? How did you feel about all the stuff about redemption and forgiveness and revenge and these cycles that we go through and the breaking of the cycles?
Yeah, I mean, it's just tough, right? Because it's just introducing the new character of Sandman. And then on top of that, not just the new character, but then you're also saying he was there in the first one. It seems very sort of unbelievable to me. And so, because you're starting the theme of revenge and all of that with somebody we'd never met before, and you're also saying, well, this story that we told you of the past two movies, it's not quite what we said. I think the fact that, like you said, speaking to the theme of vengeance, right? He kills the guy in the first movie. Okay. We can audience can accept that because we believe that he killed his father. Okay. Well, then you're retracting. Then you're saying, no, actually he didn't kill his father. Okay. Well, now how are you supposed to feel about him killing the guy in the first movie? So for you, Derek, are they saying it doesn't matter if he killed him or not because Spider-Man shouldn't have killed him anyway? Is that what you're trying to say?
Okay. So if I'm understanding your question correctly, it's like, how do we feel? Well, because Spider-Man should not have killed that guy in the first one, regardless.
At all.
Right?
Regardless.
And I think is that what they're
saying?
Yeah. And like,
okay.
Are you saying that he should have killed that guy? What are you saying?
That's the question that we're left with. That's the question the movie is asking. The first movie and this movie is asking, right? Because
I think it's definitively saying, like, don't do that. Don't do that.
Right.
Yeah. The cycles of revenge are wrong, and I think this movie is building off that. They even reference it in this movie where Peter says something about when they find out oh, this is the guy who we thought had killed our uncle.
Yeah.
And he has that moment, he's like, I went down and basically hunted down this guy and he died, and he feels very conflicted about that. And then they're like, well, don't do anything dumb, not like last time when you last found out about this killer, or this alleged killer of Uncle Ben. And he gets at the end of this that chance to, when he explains, you know, when Flint Marko kind of comes clean, he's like, yeah, I did kill your uncle. And I was thinking about this watching it, because when you see the flashback, you see it twice, right? You see it, and both times it's a subjective thing. It's not objective. It's not an objective flashback. This is not presented as what happened. This is presented as Peter Parker imagining what happened with his uncle. And you see it first that he, like Flint Marko in that original one, is crazed. He's like rabid and he's snarling and he just shoots him for like no reason. And then the other guy's like, get in the car. And he just drives and he just has this rageful look in his face and he kills him out of brutality and anger. And then when that scene was revisited at the end of the movie and you see the Sandman tell him what he did, it's so sad. You see, it's not a scene of anger or brutality. It's this kind of guy at the worst moment of his life making a mistake that he can no way undo, where someone dies, and it's paralleled with that decision that he made in the first one. So I think that thematically those work very well together. Any retcons late in the game are always a red flag.
Yes.
But
yes.
I think that because they tied it in thematically to this story, I am a little more forgiving of it than I would be.
Right. It's just for me that they said to the audience, okay, vengeance is bad. Right, in any sense. But the only, for me, the only scaffolding, the only thing that makes you question, right? Because the thing that draws you into a story is think about the morals and the ethics of what the character is doing. There is no moral quandary for his actions if you remove the fact that the guy that we thought at the beginning killed the uncle didn't do it. You take away all of that moral grayness of like, well, murder is wrong, but in this situation, I can understand him doing so.
You're saying that Peter, there's no moral ambiguity of Peter having killed the guy from the
first one. If you remove the fact that he didn't kill his father, if you remove the fact that he killed his uncle, there is, let's say, less moral ambiguity to the situation, to the events of the movie. If you remove the fact that in the other one, in the first movie, in the first movie's moral question of is vengeance wrong, is murder wrong, is completely removed if what we're to believe now, right, that the guy that Peter Parker killed didn't do anything, didn't kill anybody.
So either way, it's wrong, right? Either way, him having killed this guy is wrong. Yeah, that's the position the movie is taking.
The position the movie is taking.
The position the movie is clearly, definitively taking in those first two movies is that it was wrong. And they have a whole scene, which is one of the best scenes in not just any of these movies, but any superhero movie, in the second one, where he goes to Aunt May and he's like, hey, guess what? You know that guy who killed Uncle Ben? Spider-Man went and hunted him down.
Yeah.
I believe that's the second one. It might have been the first one.
Right.
And he's like, so we're good. And she says that, first of all, Spider-Man doesn't kill people. That doesn't make sense. And second of all, that's not a good thing. This vengeance is not a good thing. So it is.
No.
It's not at odds with what those movies were saying. It's in agreement with them.
I guess my mistake was to talk about my thought about it. The audience thought about it, right? At the same time, we talk about the movie's message and the movie's perspective and the movie's what the movie thinks about the actions of the character.
You're saying that maybe that guy did deserve to die.
Maybe. That's what I'm saying. Right. I'm saying maybe. One more thing just before we can move on. Saying maybe, based on what we knew from the first movie, during the events of the first movie, me, Damien, thought that there was a question. There was a moral conflict about whether his actions were correct or not. Now, with them saying actually he didn't do it, now I can say, based on the fact that he didn't do it, now it's wrong. I preferred it being, like you said, retconning is a really red flag. And so I would have preferred them to leave it as a question. That's all.
Okay, that's fair. That's fair. That distinction is important. Because I think that the films are coming down pretty hardly on.
Yes.
Yeah, the on films it are. Was yes. wrong. But you know, personally, I could see why. Yeah, that would
be questionable. Yeah, so not right or wrong, questionable.
Okay. That's fair.
Okay.
For me personally, I kind of wasn't questioning it, but it wasn't questionable to me. But yeah, that's I guess, you know, a matter of taste in watching taste, these movies.
True.
We said, retconning is always kind of a thing.
Yeah.
But so speaking, you know, staying on Flint Marko for a second, and you know, you mentioned there's some things that you liked about, there's some scenes in this movie that you really liked, and we haven't even talked about what I think is one of the greatest scenes in any superhero movie. It's so good, and I think the CGI surprisingly holds up.
It does. It really does.
It's the birth of the Sandman scene.
Yeah.
Where, you know, if anybody, it's that first scene where, you know, you see Marko, he's been turned to sand, and he slowly starts to reconform and reconfigure himself, and he tries to grab that locket of Adad, and it's got that great score behind it, you know, which is, as we said, done by Christopher Young.
Yes.
That score really affecting that scene, really powerful, looks incredible, something that probably could not have been done a couple years prior. Did that scene hit you in the same way, or did you feel anything watching that one?
Yeah, this whole arc is the best part of this movie, including that scene. It's done really well. Did they reference this directly in No Way Home or Far From Home, whatever it was called, when they introduce him, the Sandman. When Sandman appears in,
did they reference what?
This scene.
I don't think he was like, I was in it. Oh, he did. Yeah, he was just like, like Electro is like, I fell into a vat of eels, and it's like, oh yeah, I fell into like a vat of sand or something like that. So he does mention it.
Okay. Yeah, no, it was very good. And he's very good in this. Thomas Hayden Church is very good in this. And just to, you know, use that to talk about why the rest of the movie didn't work for me is that stuff did. No, I'm serious, because it's that stuff of like, you have a very good character here, you have a very good character arc, you have a very good backstory, you have, and it's so at odds with the dance scene, and it's so at odds with, like you said, the Sam Raimi's thing, right, is heart, and it's character development and all of that stuff that we go to the movies for, on top of the weird, goofy, crazy, out there stuff. In past movies, he has balanced it well, and I completely disagree that he balances it well here. I think having this scene, having the Aunt May scenes, mixing together with the goofy stuff, and also, I don't know, how did James Franco's performance work for you? Because again, just to answer your question, this scene did work well for me. His performance worked well for me. Everything with him in this worked well for me. But with James Franco just being this like melodramatic guy of just like, hey, Peter Parker. Yeah, that was I'm the other guy. And he does that whole turn around smirk thing, like chewing. Is just, I feel like he's in a completely different movie. You know, what do you think about Franco's performance in this?
I liked Franco. By the way, I like how I'm like, oh, this is the underrated podcast. We try to like build up movies that are kind of, and then you're just like, and I fucking hated it. Let's talk about something you liked. And you're like, yeah, I liked it, but I maybe hate the rest of it even fucking more. But no, Franco, I think, is a really, really hit or miss actor for me. But I think that Raimi knows how to use him, except for in the Oz the Great and Powerful, which is like bafflingly bad, his performance in that.
Wow.
But never, I think he's utilized well here. Like that moment when she's like, how's the pie? And he's like, so good. He's such a little shit. Like, Franco's such a little shit that you're kind of like, and he's a shit in real life. So, you know, well, I think it's,
yeah,
molester, you know,
but
it's
yeah.
It's a good performance. It's just like, you know, when you watch Seven, you're like, wow, Kevin Spacey's a psychopath murderer. You're like, yeah, also in the movie, he's crazy too, you know, like, but yeah, it's that kind of thing where it's like, yeah, I think he was good. I'm not going to say anything good about James Franco as a person.
Yeah, no.
But I think that he is utilized well. I think with the exception of Topher Grace, pretty much everyone is utilized well. We talked about Bryce Dallas Howard. I think she's great. I think Toby is really good in this. He kind of, you know, there's a reason those Bully Maguire memes have sprouted up, is because Toby's like a nice, seems like a nice guy, but he's got kind of this mean, dark streak to it. And he gets to like, that gets to come out in this movie. And right. He's like, when I was like, I'm gonna put some dirt in your eye. You know, I think that there's some genuinely comedic great moments in this that made me really laugh. You know, I already mentioned the Bernard line. I love the bit where after he fights the sand, and he's so on his high horse. He's just spent the first 30 minutes of the movie talking about how he's the shit, and he gets this key to the city, and he makes out with his not girlfriend, and all this stuff, and he's just like, yeah, I'm the fucking bet. And then he just gets his ass whooped by Sandman, and he's like, where do these guys come from? And he's like, pfft, and he's just like pouring the fucking sand out of the boot. I think that Raimi style of humor, it really worked well in this movie. Did you think it was tragic?
It was just so, yes, it was funny. And you know, I love the meme, the part that's been meme to death, where he comes home, I think right after the fight he has with Sandman, after he used the water, what do you call it? Water pipe, right? The
pipe. Oh, yeah. Would he like, bust. Yeah.
Yeah. Basically, he thought he killed him. Goes back to the apartment, and the landlord's like, hey, rent? He's like, you'll get your rent when you fix this damn door. It's just like, yes. But yeah, it is. What was your question? He was very goofy. Like, he's very funny.
Did the humor work for you in this movie?
Yes. I think, you know, the landlord is always funny. I think the daughter is always funny. You know, the whole scene with what was the scene?
Put some nuts in. You got any with nuts? Make me some with nuts.
Yeah. Oh. The one I want to talk about, Elizabeth Banks, because she's, you know, Pittsfield native. Yes. Mm-hmm. Elizabeth Banks outside the office, outside JJ's office. What is that buzzer she has that like shakes his entire table? That was his whole desk. That was very funny of him. Like, what is this one? No, not that one. This one. It's like, yes, that one. He said, what? What now? Water. Don't forget your water. It's like, yes, that was legitimately. I think that stuff in the Daily Bugle was probably some of the funnest stuff in this movie and of the trilogy overall. Yeah, well, I love that. That was my if I had one, you know, moment of like, this is good. This is what some of the best parts of this movie and of the franchise is those little character beats in the office there. Yep.
Okay. So then how would you, cause I think we would probably both put this as, I mean, I might even put it ahead of Spider-Man 1, but
bipolar is my problem with it. It's just like,
see, I do think that, like, I don't know, the scenes, because like you mentioned, the scene where like the first Sandman fight is very funny, like it's a stuck, but the second one is a lot darker.
It's like he's tragic, and I think that, it's brutal.
Yeah, and I think those tones were, and it just the same way that Shakespeare was able to go back between something very funny and something very tragic in the same play, I think that this kind of does the same thing, and it feels very big and Shakespearean, and this kind of these superhero stories are larger than life. And I think that Raimi is a really good person, and you do feel his voice. And unfortunately, I think that it does get a little bit stifled by creative outside interference. But a lot of, you know, movies today, a lot of superhero movies today, you don't get to feel that distinctive voice of Sam Raimi. And I should say, you know, because I talked about how I don't agree with the auteur theory, and his team, his frequent collaborators, because he does have, works with these guys.
In the first one and the second one, yeah.
Yeah, like, you know, it's a lot of these guys, with the exception of Elfman, came back to the point where, like, he has Bruce Campbell cameo in every one of these movies.
Yeah, I think one person, or, you know, one of the biggest actors in this movie and one of the biggest characters in the movie we haven't really talked about is Kirsten Dunst's Mary Jane. And I feel like this is, again, going back to the stuff I was talking about, and talking about the agency stuff, and she has a career. I'm not saying she didn't. I'm not saying that they didn't focus on it enough, but that felt like if you're going to have a movie with too many people in it, too many characters in it, you gotta do more with her and him in it. That's the heart of the movie. She felt like such a damsel in distress, and there are different versions of Mary Jane for the comic books. There are different versions of her in the movies. I was really feeling sorry for Kirsten Dunst as an actress and Mary Jane as a person, which I guess is the point, to make you sympathetic to her plight. But I felt depressed for her and for the character, because she just is this person who is trying to communicate with him. And again, going back to what I said earlier about miscommunication and lack of communication, probably should have said, you know, earlier, you know, that she was fired. Again, I understand that's a very, 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 very common point of conflict between any characters, is you're not communicating. You're not saying what you're feeling. You're not saying what's happening to you. If I'm going to fault this movie with it, I have to fault many other projects with that same specific point of conflict. And I get that. But she just felt so underdrawn. She felt so put in the back burner. At the end of a lot of these movies, it's just her falling. It's just her being caught. It's just her screaming. It just has very little agency. I would have preferred, you know, you're probably going to say, what do you want out of her? Her doing something, her helping him in some way, physically, emotionally, scientifically, socially.
She dropped a cinder block.
Yeah. So very, again, just this, she's billed second to this movie. And if you had asked me what was her billing, I would have said seventh out of everybody.
So I will halfway agree with that criticism.
Thank you.
Because, yeah. I don't know if you ever get in like debates with someone about a movie that you just think is okay. Yeah. And then you're like, oh man, they really like this movie, so I'm going to take the other's position.
Where you have to defend the movie that I'm shooting on.
yeah, exactly. Or, you know, sometimes it's the other way, when someone will be like, you know, if I gave a movie 3.5 stars in Letterboxd and somebody gave it 5 stars, I'm like, yeah, calm down, it wasn't that good. Or if it's the other way, it's like, I gave this movie 3.5 stars and you gave it 2 stars, I'm like, actually, it was pretty good, you know? Yeah. So I will say I halfway agree with you, that what I don't agree with what I do agree with is that she is put in the damsel in distress role again. Yes. And it's annoying that that is the third time in all three of these movies that happened. It felt like Sam Raimi and company did not know what to do with her, and to have a resolution for Harry or for Peter and Mary Jane that didn't involve him swinging in and saving her and being a damsel in distress. And none of the Tom Holland Spider-Man movies have her as a damsel in distress. She's actively helping in a lot of those in the finales.
Yep.
So there's clearly a way to do it. I don't remember the Amazing Spider-Man 1. If she was a damsel, I don't think it matters.
Did they have MJ in that movie? I thought it was Gwen the whole time.
Oh yeah, both those. It's Emma Stone. But which interestingly, it was supposed to be, I guess, in the finale of this, it was supposed to be Gwen Stacy who was the one who was kidnapped. Still, they couldn't like be like, well, how do we end a movie without someone, a woman that Spider-Man cares about being kidnapped? But they were like, it really should be Mary Jane.
Yeah,
which I think is the part of my thing that I disagree with you on, is that I think that they're emotional journey in this did feel very real and drawn out, and the whole thing about him not talking to her, rather not listening to her, is not a contrivance, but it's part of the plot. And the reason she doesn't tell him things is because every time she tries to, he just kind of talks about, yeah, it's so tough being Spider-Man, you know, but everybody loves me now. And she's just like, bro, can you just fucking stop? Like, and when she has that moment when she gets fired and she feels like she trusts Harry, who's an amnesiac, more than she trusts her own boyfriend. And I love that, you know, so it would feel a little contrived that he's like, yeah, just break up with her.
Yeah.
But that scene they have on the bridge where she's like forced to break up with him. She's doing that because he's making her. But then everything she says is completely true and is completely supported that these characters are gone. And when she's like, you do this and you do this and you do this. And it's like, yeah, he's been very shitty to her. And I think that their relationship ties into, once again, those themes of forgiveness. It's like, yeah, I've been in relationships in the past where neither of us would let things go. And we just let these small fights fester and fester and fester until we just ultimately broke up. And it's like, you know, don't do that. That's not a good thing to do. You should like listen to your partner, let them tell you their concerns instead of being like, oh yeah, like this is, I not listening and just talking over them and talking about your own shit, you know, listening to them. And then when you legitimately do something that is bad to them, like, you know, something you do, something you hurt them or betray them or whatever, learning to forgive, you know. And that's what Peter learns to do with Sandman. And that's where, and that last scene, which I love, by the way, that they don't explicitly say they get back together.
Yes.
But they've, and they don't even, they even when they kind of mention it in Far From Home, he doesn't like say they're back together, but he's just like, I have someone, we've kind of found like a good way to be, you know. They don't like go off and get married or anything, but they find a way to forgive and accept each other for who they are, which I think is very powerful and very in line with everything else that this movie has been putting forth. So, but yeah, the her being the damsel in distress, for the third time in a row, not a good look. Not a good look.
No, and you know, again, in the comics, she has some other job. I don't know. I'm not sure what it was, but just, you know, just to give her something to do. It's like, what is your job? I'm an actress. What are you actually doing though? What did you actually do in this movie? Again, just like figure out something for her to figure out, do some sort of like investigation into who this person was. Like, he could have had him say, like, I found my uncle's killer. It's like,
Damien, okay, we've already talked, there's too many plots already in this movie. You can't have
it. I know. But again, like, she's second billing. She's been in the first two movies. Yeah. She was a big reason why those movies made so much money. It's like, well, maybe you have something else to do. But anyways.
Yeah. Well, how would you rank this among the other live action Spider-Man movies? Do you think it's ahead of the Garfield ones, ahead of the Holland ones? Like, how does this play out in terms of you, compared to the other ones?
So for me, probably would say Spider-Man 1 up in the top third. Spider-Man 2 could be in the top five of all of them. Spider-Man 3, this movie, probably in the bottom three. I think it's down there. It could swap places with Amazing Spider-Man 2, I think is the consensus is that's one of the worst ones. So I would say this is down there as Amazing Spider-Man 2. As far as the Holland ones go, I think I have to revisit it. I know the first one's probably up there. First Homecoming's probably up there in the top five. Let's see. And then Far From Home would probably 6 or 7. No Way Home. I don't know if you've seen a lot of the sort of revisitations of No Way Home, but a lot of people are saying that that storyline, if you just look at it objectively as a storyline in a movie, is not great. So I'll have to get back to you on that. But as far as right now, No Way Home is probably in the top five. So to just reiterate, Spider-Man 3 is last or almost last next to Amazing Spider-Man 2 with Mr. Andrew Garfield. Yep.
Yeah, because I'll just say I really dislike the Amazing Spider-Man films, both of them.
Yes.
So those ones are like just bottom of the barrel for me.
Fair enough.
But I think this one even beats a couple of the Holland ones, and maybe even when you factor in the editor's cut, I think maybe even Spider-Man 1, to be honest. Which is a good movie, but it's very like you watch it like this is a superhero movie from 2002.
Yes.
And I don't mean it's like necessarily dated, although there is like a dated joke or two in it. But I just mean that the form hadn't really congealed completely yet. It hadn't really like set into what it would at Spider-Man 2, which I think Spider-Man 2 has like been the template of the entire MCU to a point. So I would say probably Spider-Man 2 and Far From Home, or No Way Home, excuse me, No Way Home are like the 1 and 2. I think No Way Home, yeah, the story's not the strongest, but I think that movie works very well with just, it does nostalgia in the right way where it's not cloying or anything. It brings back all these themes from all these other movies and puts them on this new character. It does a lot of really cool stuff. I like that one a lot. And so honestly, so this one I think is probably my third favorite if I'm being completely honest. So I'd say, wow. I liked it quite a bit.
Like mm-hmm. Homecoming is probably one of my favorite. Yeah,
Homecoming's
ones.
Good. I think that
Homecoming's great.
Far From Home is fine. I like it. I think it's kind of just it's kind of mid-tier Spider-Man for me.
Sorry, where did you put Spider-Man 2? This Raimi's Spider-Man 2.
Number one. That's okay. That and right. That you could that either that one or No Way Home is number one for me.
And you're saying like, this one is you could flip top three?
This one's like a bronze, but it's like not like those 1 and 2 are like way ahead. It's okay. Not close to gotcha. Those 1 and 2, gotcha. But and I really wish you would watch the editors because I think it just
all
makes
right.
Such a
all right.
And it's interesting to speaking of No Way Home.
Yep.
Which had a cut. You watch that cut and you're like, this is just some extra scenes that are just a little fun. But there right. It's completely unnecessary.
Okay.
Like that's a movie that's pretty good and it has a cut called The More Fun Edition, which is an appropriate title because it's just like, yeah, there's some extra scenes in here.
Yeah.
That you didn't really need, but they're kind of fun. Some of them deepen the characters a little bit, but mostly not. Whereas this feels like this is a cut that doesn't change that much, but what it does change makes a world of difference. And I think I bumped it up a whole star rating on Letterboxd. I think it went from 3.5 stars to 4.5 stars on my rating. So this is a movie that it was a movie that just had so much potential and it wasn't quite realizing it for me. And getting to see this version, so it's like $4 to rent on Amazon. Anybody out there who's listening, don't like if you are interested in checking out this other version and yeah. You're like, hey, I've got $4 to spend. Definitely go check it out. I would highly recommend that.
All right. I'll check it out. Definitely.
But yeah, before we completely wrap up, I mentioned that, you know, we mentioned at the beginning that about the Christopher Young score. And I really like the score. I don't know how you felt about it, but I did have a question for you. There's one thing I could not remember about the theatrical cut, but there's that theme, the Spider-Man theme.
Yeah.
The you know, that was so prevalent in the first two movies. Whereas this one, it has the Venom, which has become like a sound on TikTok, you know? And throughout this movie, you hear that Venom theme a lot. Like, it's very, like, anytime Spider-Man's starting to feel the pull of the symbiote, you get that theme. And one thing that So my question is, because I know that the editor's cut kind of restored his whole score that he wrote, which apparently had been kind of chopped up and not fully used.
Yep.
And one thing I noticed watching this, so I'm curious if it was the same in the theatrical cut, is you don't hear the original Spider-Man theme until the real end of the movie when he's going out to save Mary Jane for the last time after he's fought the Green Goblin, after all these things have happened, and he puts back on the suit. And that's when you finally, for the first time in the entire film, hear that original Spider-Man theme from those first two movies.
Yep.
And it hits you like a brick wall.
Yeah.
Because you hadn't heard it at all. You're like, you really feel like, oh shit, Spidey is back. Like, he is back. So was it the same with the musical score theatrical?
Yep.
Okay. What did you feel about that? How did you feel about the soundtrack?
Yeah, it definitely did kick in at the end there. Definitely gave you chills to hear it finally at the end. Definitely did miss the Danny Elfman score. But yeah, I would have preferred Elfman's score in this. Definitely one of those things you go to these movies for is that score. So definitely missed the Elfman score in this movie. Absolutely.
Okay. I was trying to get one positive, you to say one positive thing, but I should have known that that was a fool's errand.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, this is not, like, is it a thing where he couldn't use it? Like, it's a rights thing, or did he?
No, I think it was because he used it. And I think it was a thing that I think was done very well is that when you don't hear that movie or you don't hear that score for the entire time, you're like, yeah, this guy, he's, you know, he's not, when they withhold it, right? It's so much more powerful at the end when you do hear it. And it really made me emotional after withholding it for the first hour and 20 minutes or whatever.
Yeah.
Playing it there at the end, being like, we're back. We're fucking back. Spidey's here. I'm feeling it again. And he's ready to go. So I was so glad to hear that triumphant return of that music. It felt like completely, it's like, yeah, the character is triumphantly coming back. He's shed this shitty Venom persona, this emo haircut strutting down the street to James Brown. he's shred all that. He's got rid of the Bully Maguire. And we're back to the Spidey we know and love. And that's one thing that is so important about a musical score, is that they can cheat. They can make you feel these things by just playing a thing. And it's one of those things where less is more. By not playing it until that exact moment, it really makes it that much more powerful and impactful. And that's one thing that I think some of the modern Marvel movies haven't done necessarily as well. But one time that they have done it very well is at the end of Endgame, when all the Avengers start coming through the portals, and you hear exactly same concept. You feel like you're like, oh shit, it's happening. They got the Avengers score going. And in that same way that got me pumped up in Endgame, it got me pumped up at the end of this movie.
Yeah. I'm glad. I'm glad for you.
I've never invited you on another episode of this.
I gotta be me, man. I'm not gonna come on here and just be like, yeah, I liked it. No, I did not like this movie very much at all.
That's fair.
Crazy.
The internet has broken your mind just like everyone else in this
sure.
movie.
Do we have to do so we're gonna do it. We've relitigated this. You've come around to this thinking this is a good movie. All right, now do we have to do X-Men 3? Do we have to do Ghost Rider? Do we have to do Blade Trinity?
X-Men 3 has no, those movies were not good I don't like any of the X-Men movies.
Really?
To be honest. I think X-Men 2 is overrated, and I think
talking about the originals or Far From Home. What about Days of Future Past?
Days of Future Past is fun. I do think
yes.
Days of Future
okay.
Past is fun. That's probably my favorite one.
Yeah.
X-Men 2, though, yeah. And yeah, so the difference between those movies and this movie is those movies were like, look at the Rotten Tomatoes scores for those movies. They're like 20, and they did not make a lot of money. Although, I think Spirit of Vengeance is a movie I might, Ghost Rider 2 is a movie I might cover because it is schlocky and ridiculous and just over the top. It did get bad score. It did get bad critical scores. It did. And it hasn't had a internet resurgence like this one had. But yeah, this is a movie I think this kind of reputation's got reclaimed.
Speaking of trilogies that got reclaimed, do we have to go full blank check and just do a prequel trilogy revisit and just go down that road?
Well, that's because I don't want to get into it, but Star Wars fans, they dislike anything recent, but Marvel fans are a little better. They like the recent Spider-Man movies.
Yes.
But speaking of trilogies, like you mentioned, the prequel trilogy, this is the end of a trilogy. What is your favorite end movie of a trilogy? What's a movie that ended a trilogy right?
Well, there's so many with the MCU, right? There's the Thor trilogy. There's the, you know, Avengers trilogy, I guess, if we're going to count Avengers 1, Age of Ultron.
There's four of those movies.
Four. Okay, fine, fine. So
I'm saying trilogy, Damien.
So it's not Back to the Future. That didn't. The third one was not great. You'll probably say it's great because you like bad movies, apparently.
Everyone loves Back to the Future. You're just an old man who just
Back to the Future
angry.
Three people. Everyone loves Back to the Future.
Wait,
three.
We covered that on this show. That's a good movie.
Is it?
Yes.
All right. Let me look up some. Name me some trilogies, and I'll tell you if it's good or not.
Star Wars. You like
Which
Return
one?
Of the Jedi?
Which one?
The original.
Yes,
the,
that okay. is probably yeah, the original trilogy is probably one of the best trilogies out there. Let me see. Matrix trilogy? No. Probably the okay. There's one. There's one that's just should be on the tip of your tongue because you watch it. We watch this every year. You know.
Yeah,
it, I know
I mean, I'm asking you. I'm asking you to say it. I'll talk about mine in a minute.
Lord of the Rings trilogy is the best trilogy of all time. Yes. This wasn't this in This is a debate in Clerks 2, right? They were talking about best trilogies.
There's only one return and it's of the king.
Godfather trilogy, no. Okay, so yes, we've established, to answer your question, and to establish a champion, a king of Gondor, it is the Lord of the Rings trilogy is the best trilogy.
Yeah, I think So Return of the King is the best ending of a trilogy.
Yes.
Right? Yeah, I think that's pretty apparent.
So what are we talking about number two? Let's figure out number two then.
No, this is a number three. This is a number three Spider-Man 3.
No.
Podcast.
I'm saying the
it's another
second best trilogy. Second best trilogy.
Okay.
What is it? The Hobbits? The Hobbit trilogy? Right?
No. How to Train Your Dragon. How to Train Your Dragon is a pretty great trilogy.
Great.
How to
great
Train
score
Your Dragon
too.
3.
Great score as well. Yeah.
Very good. Toy Story. I know there's they did a fourth one, which is also good, but that third one is kind of the perfect ending to that trilogy.
What do you think about the other Sam Raimi trilogy? Evil Dead trilogy.
Oh, Evil Dead? So that would be Army of Darkness?
Yes.
I haven't seen it in a while. What do you think about Army of Darkness?
I just saw it for the first time recently, actually. I think it's one of these movies that I go back to and I watch and I'm like, there is no plot. There's literally no plot to this fucking movie. Overall, fine. It's fine. It's got the catchphrases. It's got, I think with this movie and Spider-Man 3 and with Army of Darkness, I think the supporting cast has a lot to do with it. I was going to mention like why the Tom Holland movies work for me more so. Did you say that the Holland movies were below the Raimi movies for you with Spider-Man?
Some of them are.
Okay.
I think I said I had both. I had a Raimi and a Holland in my top two.
I was just looking through the cast list. That is unbeatable. Like, comparing the supporting cast of Raimi movies to the MCU movies, just unbeatable.
Wait, which one are you saying is better?
Holland movies are better in terms of supporting cast.
No, Willem Dafoe?
Supporting
like,
cast. Supporting cast. That's one guy. That's one man.
Okay, what about Dr. Otto Octavius? You know, like they literally brought people from the Raimi movies back into the Holland movies because they were so good.
True, true, true.
Thomas Hayden Church from this movie, you know?
Let's go back to your question about best third movies. World's End.
Well, yeah. Would Spider-Man No Way Home be one, right?
Spider-Man No Way Home. Honestly, I got to revisit it. I keep hearing through the grapevine, where that word is, that the plot doesn't hold up, the story to it doesn't.
See, that's the thing. Don't worry about the grapevine. That's one thing I think has destroyed the reputation for this movie.
Says the man that brings.
Yeah, everybody. Everybody's so concerned about
the
grapevine
and the film bro. You bring in film bros. You bring in film Twitter all the time to the conversations. You're telling me not to worry about.
I'm saying, yeah, don't worry about them. Don't worry about the fact that film Twitter hates this movie because I think that's like the internet has really been like this movie's bad.
Yeah,
and I'm like, fuck that. I like this movie, and if you like a movie, fucking like it, you know. Don't worry about what the consensus is on the internet about a bunch of angry white dudes typing in their computer like, you know, George Lucas ruined my childhood, you know. That's there's a really good documentary about that.
Fanboy.
No, it's a documentary, the People versus George Lucas. And just like the anger that fan and the control that fans feel over their franchises. And I'm like, it's something that I think is happening with Indiana Jones, something I think happened with this movie, where it's just like, yeah, the internet gets mad because, you know, something doesn't work for them, and it kind of becomes the overriding narrative that, like, yeah, this is a bad movie, so you're not allowed to like it. Where do and you put, I think that's complete bullshit.
Where do you put Last Crusade in terms of third movies?
Oh, that's, you know, that's a good one. I think Last Crusade is my favorite.
Okay.
Raiders might be a better movie. They're both basically perfect.
Yep.
But Last Crusade, like, if I'm going to watch one,
yep,
and I can only watch one, I'm going to watch Last Crusade. What do you think?
Last Crusade is, just in terms of, like, again, the supporting cast, Mr. Sean Connery, great, great duo. Him and Harrison Ford made a, yeah, made a great duo. Obviously, in Raiders, it was Marion throughout it. Mm. But, and the second one was just, you know, Short Round, which was what it was. so yeah, in terms of, like, having two characters bouncing off each other, having two amazing actors work together on screen for that movie. Yeah, I would probably say Last Crusade for me. What would you say about World's End in terms of the, again, a...
That's a, first of all, that's a, that, so that's a spiritual trilogy. And I actually have not seen At World's End. So,
oh, shit.
I know, it's like been on the top of my to watch list because it's like never streaming anywhere.
It isn't.
And I worked at a movie theater when it came out and it wasn't at my theater, so I just didn't end up seeing it. It's one of my big blank spots. I mean, yeah, if we count spiritual trilogies, do we have to count Interstellar?
No, I would say
but,
no.
Yeah, I got one more for you real
just
fast.
Go ahead. Yes.
And this is a weird trilogy because it's a trilogy of movies in a franchise, but the trilogy is specifically of the movies 2, 3, and 4. And that is because they do actually form a narrative trilogy.
Go ahead.
And that is the original Star Trek films. Oh, you've never seen Wrath of Khan even?
Never seen any Star Trek movie. I've seen the Mr. J.J. Abrams' Star Trek. Haven't seen part two of that. Haven't seen... it's called Beyond, Star Trek Beyond.
Beyond is really good. Beyond is really, really good. Beyond is definitely better than the second one. But in the original ones, yeah, 2, 3, and 4 are all great. 2 is the Wrath of Khan. But 4 is also great because that's the one where they time travel back to... they didn't have any money. So they're like, well, they're going to time travel back to the 1980s. When this movie was being made, because they have to get whales. It's so goofy. It's so fun. It's directed by Nicholas Meyer, who also directed a movie with a similar premise, Time After Time. So, yeah, I think it's just a fun, goofy end of a kind of Star Trek trilogy. But yeah, those are probably my favorite part threes of stuff. Do you have any other ones?
Yeah, yeah. What is it? Is it War of the Planet of the Apes?
Oh, yeah. War is so... I can't believe I didn't think of those. Because I think that it goes Rise, Dawn, and then War.
Right.
And Rise is really good. But then Dawn is, like, legitimately one of my favorite blockbusters.
Yeah.
I think it's phenomenal.
Yes.
And War is really good, too. War is, like... Yes. It's also... It's, like, one of those times where, like... Yeah, this is still a 5-star perfect movie. It's just not as perfect as the last one.
Yes.
But... Yeah, that movie is good. I'm very hyped for the new one, despite it being a different director.
Yeah.
But yeah, War of the Planet of the Apes. That's a good pull.
Thank you. Yeah. I would probably, like I said, Return of the
Born
King.
Born Supremacy?
Born Supremacy. No.
Born Ultimatum. That's Ultimatum. What it is. Ultimatum.
I always reference that Ultimatum as having one of the best car chases in any movie, so I really have to revisit that to make sure I haven't been spreading false information. But yeah, Bourne Ultimatum, as far as I remember, it's fantastic third movie in a series. Yep.
Yeah.
Before Midnight.
Oh, you know, Midnight. It's good. It's my least favorite of the Before trilogy.
I think probably
Sunrise
agree.
Is the one that really.
Yeah.
Where they're just like it's in real time or whatever. It's not one cut, but it's like shot in real time.
Yes.
That one is one of my favorite movies.
Yes.
What about Bill and Ted Facing the Music after 20 years, finally making the third part?
That one, no.
30 years, almost.
Matrix
yeah.
Revolutions, no. Matrix, what was it, Resurrections, the fourth one, but yeah, no. No.
No, you didn't like Bill and Ted 3?
Can't say I did. What about Scream 3? All right. Scream 3? What do you think of that one?
I've never seen 3. I've only seen the first two.
Gotcha.
I hear it's not good, though. I hear, like... I mean, you know, that's just through the grapevine, so it might be wrong. But
Terminator 3.
I love Scream 2.
Terminator 3, Rise of the Machines.
That is a bad movie. That is
a bad movie. Thank you.
That's like fan fiction, that movie.
It is. It literally is. What do you think about Dark Knight Rises?
I think it gets more hate than it deserves.
I would probably agree with that. Aliens, Alien 3?
Alien 3 is, it's another one where you have to watch the assembly cut. I think it's interesting. It's low on my David Fincher rankings, but like, it's David Fincher. The guy doesn't miss. It's actually going to be one I'm going to be covering in a future episode. I've already got a guest lined up for it. So tune back for that one, Alien Heads, if you're a fan of the quadrilogy.
Finch boys, Finch fans.
The Finch man.
What are Fincher's fans called? Finch boys? Finch heads?
I don't know. I think that David Fincher would actively hate that question.
Yes. I think he probably would. Anyways.
Yeah. Thanks. Thanks for coming on, you know, and not pulling any punches. When it came
that's
to this
do.
One.
That's my whole oeuvre. That's my modus operandi, as they say, because, I don't like the whole, this thing is terrible or it's the best thing ever, but sometimes you have to call a spade a spade. You just kind of do,
And this one, I'm just going to call it what it is. Fucking great movie. I love how
it's oil and water. It's like you probably, if I had been even a little bit more positive on it, you would have been like, yeah, I don't know.
I think that I did give this movie 4.5 stars on Letterboxd. Like, I do really like this movie.
We're what do you call it? Two positively charged neutrons, and we just I push you to your most positive extremes, and I'm just like this negative thing that you're just like, no, that's actually okay, fine. I wasn't gonna praise it so much, but because you're shitting on it, I have to come with my white knight armor to this movie's defense. How dare you, sir?
I'm not for this movie. This movie legitimately I really like. I thought I was like gonna maybe get you to be like, well, I didn't love it, but these things were good, because that's the premise of the show we're on, Damien.
I will say like you mentioned a little while ago in this 3-hour podcast that you the memification of this movie, right, has definitely affected a lot of people's brains. You were correct that in my brain I am a chronically online, which means the memes, I have all seen the memes so many times. And so the part in Spider-Man 3 when he grabs Brock's camera, throws it against the wall, and he's like, later, chump, and he jumps into the river. He does like a frog splash into the river, and his butt comes out. Like, for some reason, I always think of that scene where he's like, later, chump, and he farts and jumps into the, and he hears it's the Scooby go, that's all I could think of during that scene. I was like, yeah, you're correct. You're not wrong, man. You're not wrong that my brain is permanently and irreparably broken in so many ways, and it does actually affect my viewing habits, but it is what it is.
Yeah, that's fair. That's fair.
Yeah.
Well, thank you though once again for being on.
Yeah, you're welcome. You're so welcome.
This was fun. It's a good way to relaunch the podcast. And even though, like I said, this is a movie that I think is definitely underrated. I understand there's people out there, a lot of these movies, not everyone's going to have the same opinion. Yeah. So it's always good to get a dissenting voice.
Yes.
Before we wrap up, though, I know we mentioned Midnight Film Society at the top, but where can people find that and listen to it and all that good stuff?
Oh man, where can't you find it is the question. It's on Spotify, it's on Apple Podcasts, it's on Google Podcasts, it's on all the things. Just go Midnight Film Society Podcast and Google my name. Ignore many of the allegations against me. No. Now Google Midnight Film Society, get it anywhere you get your podcast. We are doing one more regular show this year. We are not
out by the time this is out, so we got
we'll do one more regular show before the end of the year. I was gonna say we're not elite.
Yeah, the end of the year has ended at this point, Damien. We're in the future now.
Oh, we're in the future. Oh, you said that a couple times. It just went right by it. So that'll be out. That has been out. So you'll get our top 10. You will have heard our top 10 already.
Well, not that far in the future. We're past the one regular episode. We got next week. the top 10.
What's the date? What's the date? What's the release
today
date?
Today is New Year's Day. It's the first day of 2024.
Happy New Year!
Happy New Year. That's why I said that at the beginning.
That was like 3 hours ago. I'm sweating. My brain is melted. So go get my podcast anywhere you get it. Midnight Film Society on any of your podcasters of choice.
Yeah, and then follow you on Letterboxd, all that stuff, right? What's your Letterboxd?
That's a good question. My Letterboxd right now is Klaus.
It keeps changing.
Yeah, Santa Klaus Kinski. So Google, Santa, SANTAKLAUSKNSKI at Letterboxd.com. Check out all my reviews there.
Yeah, and so, yeah, if you know, you're hearing this, that means we've already recorded and released the episode on top five Christmas films.
Yes.
And next week will be our top, like you were saying, our top 10 movies of the year. I'm excited for that one. That's going to be really cool. So if you guys want to hear me do my top 10 list, that's going to be the only place to find it over on the Midnight Film Society. Me and Damien are both going to be counting down our lists.
What I was going to say was like Ringer, right? They put out their top 10 list already. All these, you know, you listened to Film Comment just recently. You said that was the most pretentious thing you've ever heard. I agree. All of these people are not the people. They don't represent the what do they call that? The people. The
salt of the earth, the common man.
We represent the common man. We will wait until the movies are actually available to see, to review them, because we are part of the proletariat. We are part of the working class. So if you are like us and you haven't seen most of the movies that people are talking about, now you can hear them. Now we'll say they are available here. They're available in Pittsburgh and Pennsylvania, and they're available where people actually work in small town America that we were for. So go and watch those movies after we review them. Thank you.
Yeah. And I will. Yeah. I will. Yeah. Very well put. Thank you.
Thank you.
I will say, you know, for my list, there's some stuff that, you know, like you were saying, critics will talk about things that are not going to get wide distribution to like March or something.
Yes.
So, yeah. Like one of the movies that I considered, I'm not saying it's necessarily going to be in my top 10 list, but one of the ones I considered is Women Talking, which was an Oscar contender last year. Yes. Won Best Screenplay. Was on a lot of people's top 10 list last year. Got a limited release in 2022. Didn't get a wide release until January of 2023. So I counted that as a 2023 movie.
Yeah.
So, yeah, as you say, we are for the people. We both still do like all the film critic-y bullshit.
Yeah.
You know, but we also love stuff like this, like stuff that is, you know, I just spent, as you say, 3 hours talking about how much I love Spider-Man 3. So I'm not going to be a pretentious film bro and be like, actually, you should watch, you know, the 3.5-hour movie about Chinese sweatshop workers that, you know, it's like, which I did watch and I did review for a, and it's fine. But it was an endurance test. Check that review out on, should be coming soon. To a local website near you, but besides that, this postamble, whatever it is, has gone on too long.
Right.
But I'll wrap it up by saying, check out Underrated Movie Podcast everywhere. We're on all the social medias. You can email us underratedmoviepodcast@gmail.com, and definitely check out the Patreon, patreon.com/underratedmoviepodcast, as it is now known, Underrated Disc 2. It's what it's called. You can sign up for the DVD, the 4K or the Blu-ray level, and you get different perks at every level, including bonus podcasts of Infinity Stones and Dragon Bones and Underdogs, which Damien has been on both of those shows.
Yep.
And then at the 4K level, which is the highest level, for just $5 though, you can choose a movie for us to review on Underrated. So thank you to all our patrons, Damien, which is of course one, so thank you, Damien.
Yeah.
And to all my other patrons out there. But thank you just for listening. Listening to us ramble about this movie that the internet hates for so long. I actually had a lot of fun talking about this.
It was
a really good time. So, hopefully you guys out there listening had as much fun as the two of us did talking about it. Till next time, though, I'll see you guys later.
Bye-bye.